Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me.
Well, as promised last week, it's time for the second part of my series marking the 400th anniversary of the founding vision of Mary Ward, an occasion which has brought over 200 of her followers to Rome this week, an effort to mark this joyful event. So do stay tuned, as in a few moments we no longer look at her story, which you can find on our website at www.vaticanradio.org, but at the reasons behind a choice of a name for one branch of her followers, the Rome branch. It's Congregation of Jesus, or Congregatio Jesu, a title which may have brought to mind the Society of Jesus. And if you tuned in to part one of this series, you recall how last week we learned how Mary Ward in 1611 wrote that she'd heard distinctly, not in sound of voice, but in intellectual understanding, the words "take the same as the society." Stay tuned. This story begins at the time of the Second Vatican Council, when religious congregations were encouraged, in an effort to go forward, to look back at the original charism of their founders.
Mary Ward's charism was so clearly Ignatian. We set up various commissions to study what it meant to have the full constitutions of the Jesuits and whether, in fact, the Jesuits and the Church would ever allow, after 400 years, a women's congregation to take these constitutions.
Mr. Francis Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, sat down with me here in our studios and explained how the Jesuit constitutions Mary Ward had called for 4 centuries ago were finally adopted in 2003, not without much soul-searching and not without the permission of the Church and the Society of Jesus. Constitutions adopted almost in their entirety. That's if you exclude anything relating to priesthood. But the question that comes to mind is, why did the followers of Mary Ward have these constitutions so much at heart after all these centuries?
Ignatius of Loyola, when he called his congregation the Jesuits, saw the entire concept as being in the following of Jesus. And Mary Ward also wanted them also to have the name of Jesus in their title. Because she never persuaded the Jesuits to let that happen, and the Church in the end suppressed her, she never gave her congregation a name.
Mary Ward may not have given her congregation a name, but plenty of others did, nicknaming her and her followers Jesuitesses or Galloping Girls in a deliberate, derogatory manner. That's during her lifetime. Subsequently, as the congregation survived and developed, it took on a very obvious name, natural at least in Germany and Italy, that of the English Ladies. It was only in the 18th century that the order actually took a specific name, that of the Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a title accepted by the 2 branches of this order, the Roman one we spoke of earlier, now called the Congregation of Jesus, and that other Irish Loreto one that never changed that name. Convinced a diverging approach to their names must have created an issue, I asked Sister Frances if, in 2003, their change of name had provoked mixed feelings.
Yes, I think feelings were enormously mixed between those who had been working hard for this, who were absolutely overjoyed and enthusiastic, to those who felt a little bit that, you know, we've got very used to the title Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary, it looks as if we're moving away from Mary. There was a feeling, of course, that both branches had had the same title. Now one branch would retain the title, the other would adopt Congregatio Jesu. You know, was that a consideration? But in fact, I find in practice, I am pleased that we have the name Jesus because it's what Mary Ward wanted.
Was there any reaction on the part of the Jesuits?
No, not at all, because they had been kept informed of our intentions right from the start. The Jesuits are aware of the history of their relationship with the congregation, which has not always been smooth. Even at the time of Mary Ward, there were some Jesuits who supported her wholeheartedly, including initially Father John Gerard, a seminary priest in England, the only person ever to have escaped from the Tower of London. Later on, when his provincial ordered him out of England after the gunpowder plot and he moved to the continent, he became Mary Ward's confessor. And it was probably through him that she got hold of her copy of the Jesuit Constitutions.
It was difficult to get hold of the Jesuit Constitutions.
It was difficult to get hold of.
I mean, they weren't. Not like today.
You
go to the bookshop.
That's
again.
Right. No. That didn't work like that. Not all Jesuits had their own copy. But Mary Ward certainly had a copy because she copied large chunks of it by hand, because she needed to know and understand what it was that she felt God was calling her to take on.
All very well, I thought to myself. That's the history of it all. But what about the followers of Mary Ward today? Where do they put her charism into practice? And how? I knew that, like the Jesuits, they were keen on education. So I put the question to Sister Frances once again, who remarked that this was possibly because education was one of the few areas that the Church once allowed women to be involved in. But she added, since Vatican II, her order began working in different continents and became involved in all areas where their presence, they felt, was most needed. Areas such as healthcare, social work, spiritual direction, and indeed in the media. Remarks which prompted a question. Does this mean that since Vatican II you've had a different type of formation?
Yes, I think it does. It has followed the Ignatian concept of formation much more. If you're forming people to go out into tough mission areas, you have to form them to be people who can not only have a deep personal devotion to God, who are prepared to face hardships and difficulties, who are prepared to take initiatives, to adapt according to local circumstances as the need may be. In the Jesuit Constitutions, it makes it very clear that the training in obedience is absolute. But once the member gets out to the mission, he's going to make his own decision as to what actually is required, because his local superior may be a very long way away and out of communication. So that you are forming people interiorly so that they can be people of discernment. Discernment is a very, very important concept, that you learn interiorly to listen to the movement of the Spirit as to what you are being called to do. And then you would normally discuss this with your superior. But if you're out on the mission field and you've got to make a decision on your own, you make that decision. Now, we wouldn't, of course, even today have sisters out in tough areas on their own.
You work in areas like, for example, STEM springs to mind, like Zimbabwe.
Yes, Zimbabwe particularly. We're very involved in the moment, particularly with our clinics trying to provide medical services to, you know, very poor rural villages.
Under difficult circumstances.
Under extremely difficult circumstances. Or we'd be working with tribals in North India. Or working now in Mongolia.
What are you doing in Mongolia?
Well, we're working under the bishop, providing basic catechesis, because there are not many Christians in that part of the world. Now we have sisters in Siberia, we have them in the Ukraine, we have them in Cuba.
So right across the world?
Right across the world. Wherever the Church has expressed a particular need and we have felt able to respond to it. So that, you know, it isn't, well, always in this place, always in that place, always in schools. There is now much more diversity.
Have you ever felt in your life that you were in the wrong order, that you'd chosen to join the wrong order?
No, I've never felt that. But I have watched with interest the development of the congregation, because when I entered many years ago, I entered the congregation in a very well-established house in a very well-established province. But I was young enough not to know really the difference between a semi-enclosed congregation and an apostolically active congregation. And looking back on it, I can see it was probably pretty semi-enclosed, because all congregations were before the Vatican Council. You had just sort of gradually had to compromise to get the recognition from the church. Well, in all our provinces, we reviewed what our ministries were, what our formation was. And because we were often in education, it was felt, no, the work in education, because you're forming people who are going to be of influence elsewhere in life of the church and in society, that is still a good work to be involved in. In other places, we may have decided that we weren't going to have the sisters to continue to keep some of these better-known educational establishments going, and therefore we had to begin the process of gradual transition to lay leadership. But that has gone on the whole very well. And that has released sisters for other work, to retrain for social work or go into spiritual ministries.
Is Mary Ward still the greatest inspiration to you?
Without doubt. She's become increasingly an inspiration.
What do you like most about her?
I love her warmth and humanity. I love her total single-minded adherence to what she was convinced God was calling her. And I love her lack of bitterness. She had no bitterness against the authorities at all. When her congregation was suppressed, and when she really understood it had been suppressed and it was not just a rumour, she accepted it as the will of God. And she encouraged her sisters to pray for our enemies. She's a real reconciler.
Our thanks there to Sister Frances Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus. By the way, the process which will put Mary Ward on the path to sainthood is currently underway. And I'll soon be bringing you an interview with the relator for the cause of her beatification, Father Peter Gumpel, a Jesuit who also happens to be a historian and theologian. Meanwhile, best wishes to the 3,000 followers of this charismatic woman. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.